Yeah, it's working. The counter is definitely working.
And can when I speak, do you see the little needle dance? And then when you speak, do you see your needle dance?
Yeah, yours is definitely dancing. Can you, yeah, I see dancing.
Dancing, dancing. All right. I see dancing too. So this is new. We're doing it. We're doing it transcontinental. That's exciting.
Yeah, first time not in your living room.
First time. More shockingly than that, this is going to be basically trading places. You arrived back in the States and I just left.
Yeah, so where are you exactly right now?
I'm in Germany on my way to the beautiful country of Georgia in the Caucasus.
Where I just happened to be.
Just happened to be. I did not know that. Well, no, in fact, I did. Tell me about your impressions. I mean, I've been to Georgia before. So how was the trip?
So it's a beautiful country. There's no doubt about that.
What is there doubt about?
No, I thought it was really beautiful. I mean, the landscapes, the mountains, the valleys. I thought it was actually quite visually striking.
Mm-hmm.
And that said, you know, it's interesting for me. I haven't spent a lot of time in how should I put this, underdeveloped European countries. When I think about European countries, I'm more familiar with the ones that are what we would call developed or advanced countries.
Mm-hmm. Do you count Turkey as a European country, or in your mind it falls outside?
Well, just because I work on the Middle East, I tend to think of Turkey as a Middle Eastern country.
Interesting. Turkey is more advanced than Georgia, right? As a whole, I've not been outside of Istanbul, so I don't know. What was your impressions in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, that was striking. I mean, that was definitely clear to me because I was first in Turkey for about a week before going to Georgia. And the contrast really stood out to me in a way that was kind of surprising because, you know, the Middle Eastern countries that I spend time, like when I think about the Middle East, I think about that's a category and then Europe, you know, so I guess Turkey's sort of at the crossroads. And in that sense, it's quite different than the other Middle Eastern countries I've spent time in. But and Georgia is also just a very small country. And so I was reflecting a bit, and well, you know, maybe we can talk about this later, what small countries versus big countries and how that changes the political dynamic. So when we were out having dinner one of the nights with our mutual friend, Ani, there were like maybe seven of us, and it was like three or four of her Georgian friends. And somewhat to my surprise, the following day, it was mentioned that three of them, like most of the Georgians who were there, were members of parliament. So there were four Georgians and three of them turned out to be members of parliament. And we were just hanging out. So I didn't it was just kind of weird that they were just sitting there with us and they seemed normal. And it's like a chill thing where we wouldn't have dinner here in the U.S., for example, in D.C., and you'd have three members of Congress hanging out with you at a restaurant and you wouldn't really be aware of it. I mean, you'd probably know they were members of Congress.
I mean, arguably, right? If you were just randomly meeting with Jordans, you wouldn't necessarily fall in with all parliamentarians. I think you just are hanging around with serious elites there, right?
Yeah. But there was something there's something unassuming about small countries with small populations that everyone kind of knows everyone else, at least if you're in the more kind of college educated capital city scene. It feels quite intimate in a way that I think is much more harder to find in big countries like the U.S., or at least that was my sense of it. And just in terms of when we were traveling throughout the country, and I feel like whenever Ani, I guess we can just keep on talking about her friend, Ani.
Sure.
Because she's just like she's a listener of the podcast. She's listened to at least one episode.
At least one.
But it was interesting that whenever she would always be very friendly with the Georgians that we would talk to. And there was a sense that there was a kind of fellow feeling, a shared identity. and that they could be friendly and they could joke and they could talk for a while, even if it was just someone we kind of met who, you know, just some random, these are just random people that we would meet and she would speak Georgian with. And obviously the couple of us who were on the trip with her couldn't speak Georgian. But like when I travel through America, if I just meet random Americans throughout my travels, I'm not like, oh, I really want to talk to you because you're a fellow American citizen. That could just be because I have a kind of occasionally a somewhat antisocial vibe. And when I'm traveling, I kind of like to do my own thing. So some of it could be personality, but I think there's also something deeper there.
Yeah, you know, a couple of things. I mean, I think on the small country thing, Croatia, for example, I remember the president for a while had this whole thing where he just basically have coffee in one of the cafes in the middle of town, and everyone just knew you go have coffee with the president. It was a thing. So yeah, I mean, you do have that sort of level of familiarity. But you know, it's interesting what you say about the sort of friendliness. Now, I mean, again, I think depends on what group you fall into, but I can tell you as a foreigner, as a naturalized American citizen, and as someone who arrived, you know, young, to the United States, one of the most striking things is, in general, complete strangers in America starting up conversations with you, whether it's about your dog or about something, about small talk, which just, again, now these are all generalizations, but I would say a lot of Europeans end up being really taken aback by that. Like, why are these people talking to me? You know, it's I don't know you. So I think it doesn't quite boil down to just small country, big country, at least in my experience. The other thing about the sort of informality about government, I don't know, you might again have a different perspective on this, but there's something maybe more an attitude of, it's a different attitude, I think, of parliamentarians to as opposed to basically our Congress people. Now, yeah, it does have something to do with the size of the country. And I think that the representation is so geographically diverse and spread out. But there's something about, I don't know, parliamentary representation that, at least in my mind, again, very anecdotally, feels more more ad hoc and therefore less formal than the sort of system we have, which seems to, I don't know, maybe and this is sort of a product of our advanced Republican decay, has somehow ossified into more formality. I don't know, just a thought.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, well, another thing too is just, so we have one congressperson for every 600,000 citizens, right? I mean, Georgia has 3.7 million people. If they used a similar system, okay, let's test my math here. That would be six members of parliament.
Right.
So clearly there's also a sense that each member of parliament in Georgia represents a much smaller constituency. And members of that constituency would probably have more direct access in a way that I don't have direct access to my member of Congress, whoever that happens to be.
Right. Well, you live in D.C., so you're not even properly represented. So,
yeah, right. That's also true. Yeah. But like when I was living in Pennsylvania, like I didn't feel like I had a strong connection to my member of Congress. And I lived in, you know, two small countries in my life, so Jordan and Qatar. And Qatar's a little bit different, but Jordan, I think, really stood out to me that I remember I got the phone number of the former prime minister, and I just like called him up. I cold called him because I wanted to do an interview with him, and he just like responded. So I call and it rings. And then this old dude speaks and is like, hello, you know, hello in Arabic. And it was the former prime minister. And I'm like, hey, someone gave me your number. Can I come and like talk to you about stuff? And he was like, yeah, sure. You want to come to my place?
Yeah.
Like there's that kind of intimacy, which I think is very unusual in the American context. And it sounds like Georgia is somewhat similar to that. But I also think that I wonder what you think about this sense that because Georgians are so few, that they all feel a certain kind of closeness, that they're sharing in a kind of national project, and one that in some sense is fairly recent. I mean, we're talking about really the past 30 years post-Soviet Union, where Georgia is becoming distinct as a nation state that is separate from that somewhat recent past.
Yeah, I mean, again, I know so little and just enough to be really dangerous to myself and my own reputation for speaking about these sorts of things. It's complicated, though, again, right? It's from what I understand of Georgian history, you know, like many nations that are very mountainous, the language, they have splits in language, and I think the sort of regional variations are also pretty pronounced. At the same time, they do draw a certain sense of identity that goes back to medieval, early times. They have claims to being, you know, the one of the first Christian societies, and their church takes its links very, very far back. But yeah, I mean, you're right. At the same time, you know, the modern identity has to be shaped with, you know, the basically the reaction to both the very recent Soviet past and then Russian imperialism, which is, you know, they've had Russians basically running their business for quite some time. The interesting thing is, of course, that the Georgians themselves have been, or at least their nobility has been, a part of the Russian Empire and participants in it. And, you know, and then there's the thing about Stalin and Beria, two of the most prominent Georgians in the 20th century. So it's a complicated thing how these identities work, especially in small countries. And you know, again, coming from the Balkans, the way these things sort of happen, these histories that sometimes are overdetermined, what people choose to latch onto, even when language is there and, you know, several different nations can communicate perfectly. It's fascinating, but it seems like there are very few hard and fast rules for how these things work.
Yeah, well, I should clarify that I was just on vacation. So,
No, of course.
So it's interesting, like you kind of absorb certain things, even though, like, I was really trying to take a break from politics. I didn't want to engage intellectually too much.
Yeah.
Which can be dangerous on a vacation, I think. I sort of did disappear for 2 weeks. And I really was very self-conscious about, like, not tweeting. I maybe tweeted one thing which was not substantive. And I maybe sent two emails that I sort of had to respond to. But it was really like the first complete total vacation that I've done in a long time for a pretty significant period of time. I mean, 2 weeks is longer than my usual by quite a bit, I would say. So, and you were here in DC, and I guess you were still working. It's a very interesting feeling to feel that you're completely detached from things that are happening in your country, and in some sense, the broader world for a significant period of time. And then you come back, and I'm not even really trying to catch up. Like, if that stuff happened, I don't need to go back in time and realize that those things happened. I mean, obviously, the bed bugs controversy got to me inevitably. There was no way to escape that, no matter how much I tried.
Yeah, look, I mean, when I was younger, when my father was younger, we would go sailing in the summer, and while in Croatia in particular, they've started putting up, or they had started putting up at the time, and now it's the entire Adriatic is covered in an actually pretty good high-speed internet. At the time, I really would disconnect, and I mean profoundly disconnect, you know, just off the grid. Maybe, you know, in the evening I could check up on the email, but more often than not, we just sort of listen to the radio to get the news, you know? And I remember the first day would be this sort of feeling of anxiety of, you know, I'm missing out, maybe second day less so. And then by the third or fourth day, I absolutely did not care, did not miss it. I could feel time just sort of taking a different pace for the whole thing. And just, it, it, it's something I really, really came to treasure. And yeah, just like you, you know, you come back and you're sort of, well, I missed it. Okay, no big deal. And you just sort of let it drift off. And I don't know, it to me, that is still one of those really important lessons about, well, the importance or non-importance of the stuff that we get caught up in, especially with all this, you know, as social media has accelerated to this level. But just in general, even before, you know, Twitter was what it was today, it was this feeling that if I'm not even following the news very closely, so much of the news that, you know, the screaming headlines, it's just one damn thing after another. You know, it definitely adds up to things, and there definitely are turning points that one needs to, you know, be on the lookout for and to understand. But so much of it is, it's contextualized by just taking a step back, the sort of relative importance of what it should be in any case, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously there were a couple important things that did filter to me that I was aware of, but if we're talking about things that don't rise to the level of like a mass shooting is important and people should be aware of that, but things short of that, a lot of it doesn't actually, in some sense, doesn't actually matter. Like if I wasn't aware of a controversy on Twitter, then was it even real?
Yeah.
Like it's almost like, because I mean, by definition, if I don't know about something, it's not real to me. And there are certain things that probably happen that I am simply not aware of. And you know, life goes on. And to kind of have that broader, like, it's hard to explain, I guess. But I think to have a broader sense that most things don't matter, some things do, and being able to distinguish between those two different categories and not getting sucked in to the minute details of the specificities of the day in and day out debate, and to just try to keep the sense of like what are the broader trajectories, and that's ultimately what matters. So I just felt like being able to kind of take that step back was really helpful for me. And I was able to kind of reflect, you know, there were things that I did think about in a much more natural way. So one thing that I think that I mentioned to you when we were talking about what do we want to at least touch on in this podcast, I kind of flippantly texted you. Let me see. I actually have it right here. Okay. It was like Demir asks on text, what's our subject? ? I respond, things I'm thinking about, : why nationalism kind of sucks, disappearing for 2 weeks, exile, democracy promotion abroad, small versus big countries. Obviously, there's a lot there.
But so the thing that was like, we've gotten through two of them.
Yes.
So go on.
But you know, it's interesting. But it's interesting that why nationalism kind of sucks. As someone who I think is in, at least in some ways, sympathetic to aspects of the nationalist turn in our politics. I mean, one thing that struck me and that I just felt kind of naturally is the arbitrariness of nation states. And I think that does, and there's reasons for that. So there was this one area of Turkey that I passed through called Kayakoy. And there's a very eerie ghost town. It's almost like an eerie ghost town because no one actually lives there anymore. There are disinhabited stone buildings, the ruins of them basically, but they're not ruins from like 2000 years ago, even though they kind of seem like that. They're ruins from the early 20th century when there was a population exchange between Turkey and Greece. So Turkish Christians, or at least Christians residing in Turkey, who were many of them of Greek in some sense, went back in quotation marks to Greece, and then Greek Muslims then were transferred, if you will, to Turkey. So this little town was basically a Greek community that was somewhat self-contained, and they disappeared or left, but they disappeared from Turkey and they were no longer there. And then these buildings became uninhabited And the Turkish authorities, I think, rightfully and importantly, preserved these ruins. And now they're a tourist attraction. But also, I think they offer a lot of insight into some pretty big questions. I assume a lot of people just like the way it looks because it's fascinating visually. But for me, I was like thinking to myself, I mean, nationalism is almost always and has almost always been a violent process of homogenization. And that's what allows nations to become nations, and that you actually have to sort people out in some sense. And the US is somewhat of an anomaly in this regard, but many European countries were able to become homogenous because of what were in effect population transfers, but also in some cases, ethnic cleansing. And we've seen more recent examples of efforts to ethnic cleanse and sort out in the Balkans. But nationalism always involves some kind of homogenization project. And to see this ghost town, this relic of the past from the early 20th century, was a reminder of the violence, even if people voluntarily prefer to live among their fellow Greek Christians, and that was ultimately their preference. Presumably some people would have preferred to stay, but I assume that many of the Greek Christians who were living in Turkey did prefer to leave. But there's a kind of violence there because not everyone did, and ultimately there wasn't a choice, and that is a violent act of population transfer.
Right. I mean, I think
it's a coercive act.
It was a war, and they were, you know, to put it gingerly, encouraged, right? I mean, there was talk about ethnic cleansing. I mean, the towns were razed, massacres happened on both sides. I mean, it was very much pushed, right? I mean, the it's again one of those things that is so interesting in so many ways. You can slice it and dice it because I was reading. I'm gonna butcher this because I don't have it anywhere near me, but I was reading this book about sort of the Balkans in the 19th century. So one of the sort of theses about nationalism, or at least sort of the one conceptualization, is that it's very much an elite project that goes down. And there are, you know, much evidence for this. And the one anecdote from this book was the frustration of, I believe it was some urbane Greek going out proselytizing for Greek identity in the countryside, and being frustrated by the obstinacy of a peasant somewhere in the countryside who, even though spoke Greek, fully self-identified only as a Christian. And I believe that again, I'm probably mangling this anecdote, but I think his church was Bulgarian. And, you know, again, when pressed on both sides, he's like, I don't know, whatever, you know, language isn't important. That's not what binds me to anything. I'm a Christian. Leave me alone. You know? So there is this sort of, and this is, it's interesting in the Balkans because it came so late. And I think a lot of this process, of this differentiation. So you have more of these anecdotes of sort of creation. It's usually accompanied by war. But, you know, I just want to maybe sound you out on this, because when we talk about nationalism and talk about the evils of nationalism, the one thing that I always hasten to add is that it's not one of those things that is really optional. You know what I mean? I think Americans in general fall into this trap a lot and say, well, you just have to get over it and learn to live together. And, you know, if only you do this, that, and then you'd have prosperity and the rest of these things. But, you know, I mean, again, there's the sort of the simplistic argument that it's a project of evil scheming elites pushing their ideas of sectarian division on a sort of undifferentiated peasantry that's actually resisting it and, you know, is living comfortably for the long time. But then there's other theories, like I think Ernst Gellner has the long theory of how basically the Industrial Revolution ends up demanding that this kind of differentiation happens. I mean, that it's a product of basic economic development that, it requires a certain kind of homogenization, a certain kind of raising of the educational level, and an education on the state level necessarily then starts privileging a common language and a common set of traditions. And then there's those other things that, you know, that again, you sort of alluded to about the, you know, the importance of religion and as a sort of sense of community, right? That these are things that bind. And sort of, you know, what I was shooting in the dark about sort of Georgian history there as well. It's interesting, and it's complicated.
Yeah, and so if you were, say, in the early 20th century, a Greek Orthodox Christian living in what is today Turkey, it's unfortunate but completely reasonable for ex individual non-Turkic Christian to say, well, if Turkey is becoming a nation state and it's going to become predominantly Muslim and will be ruled by Muslim authorities, that person would maybe prefer to live in a Christian majority country, even if they had been residing in Istanbul and loved the city and felt a kind of personal attachment to the city, that it's completely understandable that people would have a preference for a different kind of community. And I think it is hard to go from a situation where, well, before nation states, this was less of a problem. But when Turkey becomes Turkey and becomes an aggressively nationalist state, which it did become very quickly in the 1920s, that was going to be a more difficult situation for any Christians who remained in Turkey. And so when we say as Americans, well, shouldn't Christians be able to live comfortably in a Muslim majority nation state? Yes, ideally that should be the case. But do you want to take the risk? I mean, you don't know what's going to happen. And I think so. Elites are encouraging some of these population exchanges and saying Christians should live with Christians and Muslims should live with Muslims. But it's also something that resonates on a base level with ordinary people who have to make choices about what their community is. And I think there's something tragic about that, but also something something understandable and digestible. I mean, we can understand why people would incline towards certain kinds of communities rather than others. I mean, because ultimately Turkey is, even the name would suggest, I mean, it is the nation of Turks. And obviously there is a Kurdish minority, but there have been issues as well, and repression and civil conflict for the Kurdish minority. So anyway, it's just all to say that, and I think you said this earlier, Demir, that there's something almost inevitable about the nationalist turn, but there's something just sad about it. And you wonder, you know, did it have to be this way? But in some sense, it happens in a very natural way because it's happened throughout the world where people did create nation states.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think it's normal to regret the human consequences of these things. And ultimately, you know, one can't ignore the human consequences of these things. They're massive. I mean, some of the largest massacres, you know, the 20th century result are the direct byproduct of this process of nation forming. But it's, you know, I just want to come back to this because I feel like it really does keep popping up in our politics. And I'm not saying this as someone who is particularly enthusiastic about this turn towards nationalism on the right, because I think it's not well considered. I think people are trying to now appropriate this word in some sort of way to justify a certain kind of politics. But at the same time, as a reaction to this, a certain kind of really, I think, quite frankly, stupid approach to thinking about these issues is cropped up in the way we talk about it. I don't know. There was that notorious explainer in the New York Times maybe 2 years ago about, you know, nationalism, and really was framed in the sense that it's an unmitigated disaster and the product basically of some kind of false consciousness, you know, and that it dovetails also very nicely to that sort of the type of thinking, you know, the you might call sort of liberal world order meliorism for shorthand, you know, this idea that, well, you know, we've transcended this, or at least part of humanity has transcended this. And the role of the of this transcendent part of humanity is to spread the good word of post-nationalism and things like that. I personally, as a committed secularist, I can smell out the religiosity, the sort of messianic fervor in that kind of talk, and it just strikes me as just that, you know, basically messianism, not really grounded in any sort of understanding of what how the world has been operating, on any understanding of history, and I think, you know, a pretty shallow understanding of anything outside of the United States by a lot of these people.
But so I would just one thing I would just maybe counter on that. So I'm not a committed secularist, as I think our listeners may be aware. So I think that human beings, and we've sort of touched on this in previous podcasts, that human beings are believers. There's a need to believe. There's a desire to believe. And it then becomes a question, if you take that premise, of what do you choose to believe in? Now, the nation state is one option. A local religious community is another. The family, if you want to really dial it down to kind of the basic units, the family is another option. And some people want to essentially make the state into what is, in some sense, a bigger family, with the leader as the father figure or the founding father of the nation and so on. So all these things kind of mix together in interesting ways, but we have to choose some level of community. And now, I guess, Demir, you probably don't identify with a particular believing community in a secular or metaphysical sense, although correct me if I'm wrong, and probably, I suppose, friends, like a friend group or an intellectual community, the one that I guess we both would maybe think that we're part of here in DC, however you want to describe that, perhaps that's a kind of believing community. But I think, like, at some basic level, even if it doesn't apply entirely to quote-unquote bad elites like us, most human beings need to believe in community.
For sure. Only thing I was getting at, that there's a kind of ideology that I think has sprung up, and you see it in, I would say, in a, you know, basically our set, if you want to define it very broadly, I forget if we've actually referred to it this way, but I like to talk about it as the religion of Americanism. I was saying just I think that our larger social group is beholden to a different kind of religion. I'm not sure if we've referred to it before to a certain extent. And I would say that you know, perhaps the Germans have it even worse than we do. And it is this sort of idea that it's an ahistorical view of the world. It's an inherently progressive world view of the world, and it's messianic in the sense that it believes that the world can be transformed in the image of itself. In the case of the Germans, the recent 20th century history has encouraged them to transcend their past and adapt this, I think, you know, profoundly post-historical approach to things based on strong commitment to these values and a belief that if only you internalize them strongly enough, you can also become part of this church. I, for good or for ill, have never felt a part of that church, the Church of Americanism, even though as I've told you before, becoming an American was a profound experience for me. But I have never fallen under the sway of the belief that the world could be transformed into this solely by the force of ideas. And that's sort of my reaction to when people criticize nationalism. It's not to say that nationalism hasn't caused immense human suffering, but it's that to wish it away is to, I think, profoundly misunderstand the human condition in some level.
Okay, so just listening to you right now, you know what? I'm just kind of spitballing, and just this might not actually be particularly insightful, which our listeners have probably become accustomed to by now. But so I don't see myself as a nationalist, because I'm skeptical of the entire project, and I see, you know, for the reasons that we just discussed. But I would say that if anything, I'm an Americanist. So Americanist, in the sense that maybe I believe in nationalism just for one country. I think a kind of distinctive ideological American nationalism that is idea-centric rather than ethnically determined. I'm a believer in that, and maybe that's not really nationalism.
Is it a belief in the American project, or is it the belief of the exportability of that?
Both. Well, I think it would be hard to believe in the American project without believing that it has some applicability beyond our own borders. I mean, that is part of the American idea. Can someone truly be an Americanist without believing that there is something to share in a kind of almost religious sense, in a missionary sense, if you will, with other parts of the world? Maybe not all aspects of the American project, but we at least presumably would believe that some aspects are universally applicable. And I think from my standpoint, I'm different in that I don't think the American version of liberalism is that exportable thing. But the more minimalist proceduralist aspects of democracy would be, to me, something that Americans can or should think that all people can have or are capable of having. So maybe that's how I'd put it.
Yeah. I mean,
and that's obviously, that's, I mean, one day we're going to have like a full on episode about democracy promotion abroad where we're going to completely disagree with each other.
I mean, already there, but let's, you know, we probably have to bracket that. And I definitely want to prepare before I go head to head with you on that one.
But can you believe in the American project without believing in some aspect of exportability? And this is an open question. I mean, what do you think?
I think exportability is a lot more difficult than most Americans give it credit for, because, and you know, I mean, to flip it back on the question of nationalism, the question of nationalism posits the question of what is culture. And, you know, I think in many ways it's a cheap shot to say, well, culture, that's why you can't export. And, you know, culture is stickier, and there are certain elements of American society that are part and parcel of its culture that allow individuals to come in, but doesn't necessarily transfer very neatly to the rest of the world. But what is culture? I mean, I'm just, to a certain extent, I'm just shifting the goalposts. And then, you know, one can start analyzing these. I think, you know, you're part of the way there when you talk about the exportability of liberalism to fundamentally Islamic societies, where the contradictions are there, what's workable, what isn't. But it's you know, the sense is that also simply saying democracy or, you know, the dignity of the individual, these are also very broad terms, which I think, you know, end up being interpreted very differently in different places, even if there's only one set of terms for it. So I think it leads to a pretty large conceptual muddle with a lot of people who are trying to, quote unquote, promote democracy around the world. They have a certain vocabulary. They talk about these things. It works and doesn't work in different ways. I still think that the main problem with all of this is that there's a lack of humility to just how tentative and how difficult and how long-term this stuff is, and how we're talking about individual cultures developing in unpredictable ways. And that from my perspective, I think the nudging and pushing that we do is as often as ineffective as it is proactive on these things. So again, that's my approach to Americanism is I think that America itself is exceptional. You only have to live here for a while to fully appreciate how different it is. And I don't have a, you know, some kind of philosophical problem with the idea of, at least a conceptual idea of these values as pertaining universally, even though I sort of bucket them as moral categories, which are subject to interpretation. But, you know, in the actual application of this stuff on the ground, I think most people, most Americans in particular, are far too optimistic and sanguine about both the possibility of doing it and the good that their efforts do in furthering those goals.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so there's a lot there, and we definitely should explore, like, especially after I finished the whole Brooke book, Our Man, which I still haven't finished, but that would definitely give us some fodder for more of this. But just kind of, so just a couple things when you were talking that are appearing in my head right now, and maybe they can be a preview for some future conversation. But one reason that I'm a critic of nationalism, while also being somewhat sympathetic to it, is democracy inevitably produces nationalist sentiment. And because I prioritize democracy over other values and objectives, that if democracy then produces or results in nationalist outcomes, I then see nationalism in as maybe not preferable, but it becomes almost inherently okay or good in some sense because it's a product of something that I value dearly.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. It's that democracy promotion, the democracy promotion community to a certain extent, and this is why most people who do democracy promotion insist on liberal democracy, not democracy, because oftentimes just plopping down democracy on a society and setting expectations without, I think, the broader cultural framework that is required for liberalism to work does lead to substantial bloodshed as these societies, you know, come to understand themselves and then demand group autonomy. And this is where then you get all this talk of, well, we're not talking about democracy promotion. We're talking about sanctity of the individual, individual rights, protections. And it's those things that are not sticky. And I think it's why I think the whole project is quite fraught.
Yeah, but Demir, but not. Yeah, but not even blood. I wasn't thinking so much of bloodshed because that's not a good outcome. I mean more that, like, if we talk about somewhat stable democracies in Western Europe, here in the US, I mean, nationalist sentiment has risen in almost all of these cases in what are otherwise, you know, pretty advanced democracies. And this is why when I think about, like, Yoram Hazony's nationalism project, which we talked about in the first episode, where you have, I guess, like, neo-populist Trumpians who want to give intellectual coherence to a kind of nationalist sentiment in America. I mean, that again, like, that's not my project, but I see that the fact that democracies are producing this in rather diverse contexts, and even if we go beyond advanced democracies to talk about like India or the Philippines, The very fact that it's being produced suggests that enough people want it. And I know that's a little bit circuitous and tautological, and it doesn't have to lead to violence. And in many of these cases, it isn't leading to violence. It's leading to illiberalism. It's leading to right-wing populist parties rising. But I think there's something inherently legitimate about that, even if it's bad, in the sense that this is clearly what a large enough constituency will probably want for the rest of our lives. Like, I don't see it as something that's going to subside where it will go back to like 2% of the population or 5%. There might, for the rest of our lives, be a solid 20 to 30% right-wing populist or neo-populist constituency that will almost be a permanent part of our societies. And for that reason, and because it's a product of democratic competition, should be seen as inherently legitimate and part of and a real part of the national fabric and the national conversation. So that's sort of, I guess that's sort of what I'm getting at. And that's why I can't, I can be critical about nationalism in a kind of intellectual sense when we're talking about the Yoram Hazoni or this that project here in the U.S. or more broadly. But I'm not going to condemn it out of hand or see it as fundamentally bad.
I mean, I agree with you on that. I just wonder at the same time just about precision in a lot of these terms. And especially on the nationalism question in a place like the United States, it seems particularly incongruous because I think it's being used in a weird and not particularly coherent way. I think I'm more comfortable thinking about that a kind of permanent, maybe reactionary 30% has risen up. I wouldn't necessarily say that reactionary necessarily will always map onto nationalist, or that how it maps onto whatever they call nationalist. I mean, you even alluded to it. It's different. It's very different in the depending on the context. But I do think that there is some kind of permanent force that is emerging in all these countries. I think that's right, and it is legitimate. I think that's right. When we talk about nationalism specifically, I'm a lot less inclined to talk about legitimacy for the reasons I was saying. It just seems to me that that nationalism just is and is something that arises. The way it's coming up now in these things is, I don't know, I'm too close to it to be able to tell whether it's part of a broader sort of historical thing or not. In general, that's my feeling on that.
Yeah. Well, so, okay, Demir, I think I might have to leave, but there's two things that I want to just put out there, and we can maybe, but just things I would like to talk to you more about maybe next time or in some future podcast. Yep. I'm really interested in this idea of exile, and we didn't really get to it, but, you know, when I was in Turkey, I spent some time with what I guess you could say are members or people who are in some sense part of the Syrian exile community. I mean, people who are, and there is a fair, you know, there is a big Syrian community now in Turkey. And these are people who may never be able to return to their country, in this case, Syria, as long as Assad is in power and there's some aspect of civil war, civil conflict in at least some parts of the country. And I've just been thinking about, like, what is it like to live? What is it like to feel or to know that you can never return to the country that is yours? I mean, and we'll never, I guess we can't really feel that, or like, God willing, we'll never be able to feel that. In the sense that we're Americans, and America would really have to change in a fundamental way and have like some serious civil conflict for us to be exiles in or from our own country, right? So it's something that we can only like study, and we can listen to people's stories, but in some sense it's foreign to us as Americans, that feeling of exile. And there's something about it that's quite terrifying to me when I think about what of not knowing, because there is a chance that the situation in your own country could change, but you don't know. So you're always living in between states or in between emotional states, not only just physical states, of never knowing where your place really is in the world and always feeling that it can change at any given moment. Also because where you happen to be in exile, like something, things can change in Turkey where there's less welcoming or less tolerance for a prolonged Syrian presence in the country. So anyway, those are just things that I was thinking about over the course of my trip. And I don't know, they've been weighing on me a little bit. And also the fact that the responsibility that we as Americans have and this is where the democracy promotion, but also the humanitarian intervention aspect of it comes, that there was a failure and a betrayal, in my view, of the Syrian people that has led to this very depressing, tragic situation. But this is just maybe a preview for our listeners and also for you. Like, hey, that would be cool. Like, we should probably like talk about it. It could be interesting to talk about some of that more.
Definitely. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Great.
All right, man. Well, I'll talk to you soon.
Well, have fun in Germany.
Yeah, we'll do.
Okay.
See
bye,
you.
Amir. Bye. Later.